Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Sheila Sunder, whose wonderful new novel is Habitations. We'll also hear from Adam Carlin, whose first book for middle grade readers is Luna and the Heart of the Forest. It is a great pleasure to welcome Sheila Sunder to The Reading Life. Sheila is a professor of English and creative writing at the University of Mississippi. Her writing has appeared in the Massachusetts Review, the Virginia Quarterly, the Threepenny Review, and Crazy Horse. She lives here in New Orleans with her husband and three children, and today we're talking about her eagerly awaited debut novel, Habitations. Welcome, Sheila.
Thank you, Susan. It is so good to be here.
Oh, it's so good for me, too. I've been thinking, who can I talk to about this book? And here you are. So,
here I am.
Now, this is a novel about finding and making a home, partially. It's a novel about many, many things. But tell us about your protagonist, who is a peripatetic academic, and tell us how this character grew in your mind and heart over time.
Yeah. I think before I came to know the emotional contours of her life and even her backstory in great detail, I knew that she was peripatetic. I knew that she was restless, that she moved quite a bit. And in part, that's because those are the people that I've known, and those are the people whose lives I can imagine. That's the life that I can imagine. So that was, in some ways, an entry point into understanding her psyche, that she was someone with deep ties to home, but a really strong impulse to go and find the place where the conversations were happening that she wanted to be a part of, and that she was pulled in equal measure, in equal part, by her intellectual ambitions as well as her emotional and familial needs. And so I knew that she would not make quick, calculated decisions. I knew that she would not move where the best opportunity necessarily was, but she was someone who really struggled to balance what made her feel comfortable and home, and with her sense of which rooms she could be in where the conversations were most vibrant.
Now, one of the great strands in this book, as is in many, many books right now, is that this is a novel about grief, which is the great subject now, I think. And her complicated grief over her sister, Ashwini. And I love it when she tells one of her best friends later on in the novel that she's been sullen and angry for 15 years. And how many of us can say that? A lot of us, I think.
Yeah.
But that sense of loss deepens her as a character all the way through that she carries with her.
Yeah. It's interesting. When I first envisioned Vega, this particular loss hadn't registered to me. And in some ways, it came to me because I was deepening my connection with her in the way that you, when you write a character, it is like getting to know a person. They've lived these full lives, and you haven't, you're still a stranger to them. You haven't accessed their story yet. And so I kind of knew her in many ways in the way that many of the people that she whose lives she passed by, many of the people she came across knew her in her life as a student, as a professor. She doesn't expose this loss to the average person. And so when I first started understanding her, I hadn't accessed that either. And so in some ways, I saw her the way that any casual acquaintance of hers would have. And of course, that's not enough to you can't write a novel based on a distant understanding of somebody. And so much of the work, for me at least, is, as I began to envision this book, really what it was an attempt to understand this mysterious woman. And when this idea of grief came to me, and it seemed like it came to me in the way that there was this tough secret that this character exposed to me, I had not thought extensively about grief before writing the book. I could not imagine the loss that she had endured. And in many ways, that was the work of writing the book, trying to imagine this unimaginable loss and trying to imagine all of the ways in which you are masking as you go about your life. You are pretending that you don't hold this terrible, terrible weight inside of you. And as I wrote this book, I felt physically sort of ache in my throat, the feeling you have when you're about to cry. And I guess you don't ask people that. What does it feel like for you when you're about to cry? So maybe this is how we all feel. Maybe this is more of a biological function than that we all experience. But when I'm on the cusp of tears, I always feel this ache in my throat. And the feeling of suppressing that was one that I knew she was carrying with her. And what a thing, you know, for anybody who's experienced something that other people, either if they have experienced something of a similar magnitude, they don't share it. That's not how we introduce ourselves. And if we have not, then we are on the other side of this wall. And so she's moving through the world in a way that would be complicated for anybody. She is, as you said, she is peripatetic. She is looking for home. And that's hard. That is a hard process. And the world is a place of great opportunity. And with great opportunity comes great loss, too. You chase something down. You pursue something that seems like the right fit for you. And when you look back, you realize that you lost something tremendous, or you lost a number of small things in the process. And so as she is moving through a world of really hard negotiation, the hard negotiation of being an immigrant, she also has that feeling in her that I want to talk about this and to never talk about this.
One of the things you do that is so brilliant in this book, because reading this book is so deeply satisfying. It's like sitting there with your best friend, your smartest friend, and talking about everything that really matters in life. Politics, love, family, books, everything. It's all in here.
The nicest thing I've ever heard anybody say, Susan.
No, but that is what it feels like. It's a companionable book, you know, in that way. It made me very sad when it was over, I have to tell you the truth. But you've done something so brilliant in giving her this huge professional portfolio, because all of her interests just open the door for you as a writer. You know, there's the differences between men and women, and some of those differences are very funny. Mm-hmm. You're very good at that. I mean, the difficulty of combining motherhood with professional ambitions, global inequality, caste and class, all those things. And you've given her a chance to reflect on her own life of privilege. You don't spare her or let her off the hook in any way because of this. And it has that sense of you bringing everything you knew to bear on this one woman's life. You know what I mean? Did you feel that way when you were writing? Did you feel that you were stretching it? Because you were an historian first, right?
Well, I was a history teacher, and I did quite a bit of work in history curriculum. I was an English teacher and then a history teacher as well. I worked first in New York City schools and in international development for 2 years in Egypt, and then moved to New Orleans from Cairo, and not a very well charted course, or not a very common pathway to the American South. But yeah, I think there's a lot of work in this book, and I have so many answers to this question, so I'll try a few of them. And one is that I, for many, many years, been writing in the margins of my life while I was teaching, while I was raising children, while I was trying to just figure out how to be a person in the world. How do you make time for yourself and do a job that's really hard and come home and get dinner on the table and breathe a little bit? And so much of my early writing life, not a single word of those that I generated during those years, I think, is on the page directly. But I spent many, many years just working and writing and thinking that I wasn't living my actual life, because I knew that I wanted to be a writer. And I knew for a long time that until I became a writer, I would not be happy, like happy in a full way. I knew there was a lot that I was grateful for. I loved having kids. I loved my family. I loved my marriage. I loved my parents. I loved my friends. I loved a good meal. I loved all the things that we love in life in parts, but the whole of it was not the life that I wanted. And I knew that I would not be until I was a writer. And of course, I was a writer. I was writing, all the time, but I wasn't the writer that I wanted to be yet. I hadn't yet achieved that, and I hadn't finished my book. So in my mind, all of those hours between 7:30 and 4 o'clock, they were good work, but they weren't serving my writing life. Again, I felt as though I don't know what the right metaphor is. I was swimming through a sea and trying to feel my way through it. I had to crack open the snow globe and enter it. And I was spending years and years sort of chipping away at the outside of it, just mm-hmm. me and a chisel and trying to figure out how to get in. And once I got in, the world already existed. But that world wouldn't have existed if I had not been a teacher, had I not spent right. many years doing the tedious and physically demanding work of raising young children or being a friend or a partner, all of the components of our lives. You know, I think this book is about motherhood, but the experience of writing the world we've lived in doesn't depend on motherhood or any one pursuit. It's just all the time we're spending living is time that we are spending writing our books. We might not know it.
Right.
So when I came to Vega, I could imagine the world she had lived in. It didn't mirror in any way. There's very little she does in her life that mirrors. It might by coincidence possibly mirror. There might be some similar institutions or some similar addresses. But the actual emotional, intellectual contours of her life were ones that I really had to step into. Those were not mine. Those were hers. But I could imagine the rooms that she was in. I could smell them, you know, when she's at the Hope Center in Brooklyn. I knew what that subway ride felt like. I knew of the 7:30 or 8 in the morning, exactly what it would feel like, that it would be a subway ride she would share with families. I could imagine them. And I could imagine the particular discomfort of being somebody working in a room full of students whose lives she may have had some sort of intellectual, academic understanding of, but the actual reality of working alongside them and serving them was completely alien to her. And that's also a point that I'd love to get back to. The experience of race and service in this book was one that tripped me up for many, many drafts. But once she got into the world and she was working in it and operating mm-hmm. in it, I got where she was going to go next. Not because she had followed a path that was similar to my own or that in any way any of this was autobiographical, but because I could imagine that world so vividly. And I'd put this strange pressure on myself when I decided that she was a sociologist, but it just felt right. I thought, well, here I am writing somebody who has these credentials that I don't have, who is in many ways far smarter and more engaged than I am, who's just accessed conversations and books that I haven't accessed. And I remember putting this great pressure on these early drafts that I would, out of nowhere, put her in the room where she just delivered something that I thought was brilliant. And a friend of mine who's a great writer, Victor Yang, said, you need to ease the pressure on her a little bit. Just let her be. Trust that she's smart. And the reader doesn't care what she thinks. I mean, that'll come. But let us in on how she feels. And I really valued that advice. I leaned hard on that. Mm-hmm. That, of course, the beliefs that we hold are going to enter our conversations. But actually, we're emotional people moving through an emotionally complex world and existence. And sometimes, you know, the intellectual thoughts that we have that are really worth talking about are ones that strike us on a really deep emotional level, ones that hurt us. And we are mm-hmm. hurt by issues of race and caste and class and responsibility. Those aren't intellectual questions. They're deeply emotional questions. They can be gutting questions. And so when I really followed her closely, when I paid attention to how she felt, she did come upon those conversations, because how she felt was that it was really hard to live in a world where you had inherited privilege and you did not know what to do with that. Mm-hmm. And what she really felt was this strange experience of watching privilege like currency change value, and the strange experience of missing certain parts of occupying a particular rung in Indian society and then not occupying that rung when she yeah. came to the U.S., even though that also was a conscious decision. She talks about that, how she actually, you can't shed the generation upon generation of unearned, undeserved privilege. But sometimes you're aware of its absence and you miss it and you feel bad about that. And other times you are just relieved that to be unburdened by it. And other times you feel a responsibility to give back in a way that you don't always know how to do. And those are uncomfortable, very yeah. emotional feelings that we have.
We've been talking with Sheila Sunder, whose new book is Habitations. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan, so much.
It's a great pleasure to welcome Adam Carlin to celebrate his first book, Luna and the Heart of the Forest.
You may know his journalistic byline. He has written on travel, crime, COVID, and civil wars, both contemporary and historical, for all kinds of publications. He's a regular author for Lonely Planet, where he's contributed to dozens of guidebooks covering Asia, Africa, and North America. Adam has his MFA in fiction writing from the University of New Orleans and teaches at the New Orleans Center for Creative Arts. Adam Carlin, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me on.
What a fine fantasy adventure for young readers this book is. And the story had its roots in a real life experience, not an experience I'd much like to have.
Right. The real life experience that it has its roots in is the experience of traveling to a place and feeling kind of inspired by it and, dare I say, enchanted by it. And I use those terms cautiously. Right before we started this interview, I talked about coming to New Orleans originally in 2009 to work on a Lonely Planet travel guidebook. And I fell, like a lot of people in their late 20s, like I fell in love with New Orleans and I decided to live here. And I think at the time, especially somebody writing travel content about New Orleans, it's so, you hear that word used so often, it's a magic place. And I cringe at that, right? Because that implies, I don't know, it glosses over the warts of a place, right? And I think that when I was in Newfoundland, I think that I immediately felt this kind of inspiration that certain places have engendered in me. And I think that it's easy to think of Newfoundland as a magic place. And I think if you do any kind of, if you've been there, or if you do any kind of internet search of just images of it, it looks magical. The people are very friendly, and that's also a travel writing cliche and trope that's used too much, but it is true that people really are incredibly friendly and welcoming and warm, but it also has its issues, like New Orleans has its issues. And I think when I say a place is magic, I want to use that in its oldest, deepest meaning, which is a place that can change you. And a place that can change you can have a lot of beauty, but it can also have a lot of pain and trauma. And I tried to work all of that into this novel, like successfully or not, but that was a thing I was going for.
So give us the bare bones of the plot.
Luna is an 11-year-old girl who is obsessed with adventure and exploration. Her father is a widower and a journalist. He takes an assignment in Newfoundland, which, if you're not familiar with it, it's a province, the easternmost province in Canada. It's an island way out in the North Atlantic. They get there, and the tension between father and daughter is that she really wants to go out and be independent, and he is always, partly because he's a widower, he's always very cautious around her. And then she ends up going on her own into woods and kind of crosses the threshold into a sort of magic place where she both is able to accomplish a great thing by defeating a sort of monster in the woods in a sort of recasting of the old mythological riddle contest, but then also unleashes a darkness that ends up devouring her father in a way and threatening everybody on the island. And she has to do her real growing up, which is kind of fixing the mistake that she made.
And talk about the mythology and folklore of the Canadian Atlantic. That makes the story so rich.
Thank you. I agree. And in a way, I feel like in some ways I've done the island of Newfoundland a disservice because the mythology and folklore in here is inspired by that place, but it also takes inspiration from my own love of mythology from around the world. And I've tried to incorporate, I guess in some ways I can be a geographic essentialist. I think certain places produce certain myths and stories. I think the swamps of southern Louisiana produce a certain kind of story that I think is echoed in subtropical swampy places. As a journalist, I've been assigned to places like Mongolia and Alaska, and I think the taiga, these northern forests and tundras, produce their own mythologies and stories, and those are what I've tried to incorporate here. So it's stories of a land that is raw and rugged, but can also be unforgiving, and a land that can try and really devour you if you're not careful around it.
It's so rich. I mean, there's the fantasy quest, there's the rich mythological framework. There's such innovative battle scenes. But one of the things that distinguishes that is this rich language. It's so lovely and so much fun to read. So talk a little bit about that and a little bit about the climate fiction that's in there too.
Sure. So I was saying that fantasy sparked a lot of my imagination, but the way that that then wove itself into the written word was always inspired by the places I was in. And I think that that's why I became a quote-unquote travel writer or a guidebook author. Like, place has always been very important to me, and the ability to write place is just, that's where I've always felt my strongest lyricism. And I think that that's because places and landscapes are their own kind of lyrics and song, right? Like, to bring it, if you really want to bring it back to fantasy, Tolkien writes of, like, his world is created by song.
Narnia too.
Narnia too. And actually, my favorite book, honestly, and books are the Earthsea series by Ursula Le Guin. And she very much makes the case that what magic is, I'm sorry, I'm going to mangle the quote, but it's the language spoken between the stars, right? That language is both a reflection of, it is how we communicate, but like the world we live in is its own connected stories of like geologic place. And I think that that's something, I don't know, that's, I love writing that and I love trying to tap into that. And that informs the landscape descriptions within this book. The threat to place and the threat to the land is also at the heart of some of the climate, I guess, parables that are present. And really, I don't want to limit it to just climate parables, even though that's the most obvious consequence, but it's the parable of greed.
And the social context for climate change.
Totally, right? Like, it's not like we've wrought climate change in a vacuum. Like, we've done it because we just want to take and take from this planet until it can't sustain us any longer.
I'll be interested to see if a lot of Lonely Planet settings turn up in future books.
Well, that's for sure. But I will say this one comes from a place, I actually took my daughter with me on my Newfoundland assignment. It was a kind of very grand take your kid to work day. And so a lot of the seeds of this book, like, are originally planted. Her and I were hiking around these woods on a windswept Atlantic coast. And I turned around to take a picture. And then I turned back around and she was running into the woods. And that was, you know, they are deep, dark woods, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not that I was scared. I just saw her running with the same sense of, like, curiosity that I think, I don't know, where do you end and your kids begin, right? But sure, I saw something of myself there, and that surely inspired it. So yes, Lonely Planet destinations will probably make an appearance in future books, but there is something unique to the way that this grew out of that.
We've been talking with Adam Carlin, whose new book is Luna and the Heart of the Forest. You can meet him Sunday, April 14th at 4:30 at Blue Cypress Books. Adam, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. I really appreciate it.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Johnette Downing, author of Singing Waters, a selection of haikus, senryu, and haibun, will read her poems and then conduct a haiku workshop for adults, Saturday, April 13th at 2 at the Old Metairie Library on Metairie Road. Adam Carlin discusses and signs his debut novel for children, Luna and the Heart of the Forest, Sunday, April 14th at 4:30 at Blue Cypress Books. One Book, One New Orleans hosts a reading with Mona Lisa Saloy, author of Black Creole Chronicles, Tuesday, April 16th at 6 at the Will Alexander Library at Dillard University. Korean poets Soo Ha-young Bai, Jiayun Ha, and Wang Yuan, translator and poets Jake Levine, and poets from Louisiana Rodrigo Toscano, Bernardo Wade, and Christine Kwan will perform Wednesday, April 17th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The Creative Writing Workshop at University of New Orleans, visiting writers Jennifer Sperry Steinorth and Erica Hodges, present a reading Wednesday, April 17th at 5 in the Liberal Arts Building, Room 197, UNO. Professor Devaney Loser of Arizona State University presents the 34th Annual Josephine Gessner Ferguson Lecture in English Literature, Thursday, April 18th at 7 in the Stone Auditorium at Tulane University. She is the author or editor of 11 books on Jane Austen and literature by women. Michael Allen Zell, author of The Last Shadow, and Danny Cherry Jr., author of The Pike Boys, discuss their new novels Thursday, April 18th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. and Happy 30th Birthday to the Jew and the Lotus by Roger Kamenetz. He will celebrate with a dialogue with Zen Buddhist teacher Norman Fisher in town for the New Orleans Poetry Festival, Thursday, April 18th at 6:30 at Tulane University in the Lavin Burnick Center, room 215. And coming up, the Friends of the Jefferson Public Library Big Book Sale runs April 12th through 14th at the Pontchartrain Center on Williams Boulevard at the Lake and Kenner. Hours are Friday and Saturday, April 12th and 13th, from 10 to 7, and Sunday, April 14th, from noon to 5. Free admission, free parking, cash or credit cards, no checks. And don't forget to get your complete schedule of the New Orleans Poetry Festival at nolapoetry.com. The festival runs April 18th through 21st at various locations and expands statewide with the New Orleans Poetry Festival Roadshow beginning April 16th. The Friends of the New Orleans Public Library hold a really, really big book sale Saturday, April 20th from 11 to 3 on the porch of Ladder Library on St. Charles Avenue. Member shopping only from 10 to 11 Saturday. And the 2024 Walker Percy Weekend takes place June 2nd through 3rd in St. Francisville. Check out walkerpercyweekend.org for complete schedule and tickets.
Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, with major support from Rouse's Markets. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.